Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. It's the June edition. Welcome back, Gary.
This is one of my favorite months.
It's a great month. I say that paradise is in Michigan is in June, but that's my personal opinion.
We probably have the best weather in June most of the time.
It's warm, but it's not too warm. Of course, there will be extremes. There'll be cold weather. It's Michigan. There'll be hot weather.
Yeah.
But it makes me think of being in Hawaii in June.
Yeah. Without the humidity.
That's
sometime.
Right. Sometime. And we have Sue Majeure. We're doing this in three different locations. Our home base here in Cadillac, Michigan, at the broadcast center of Strong Tower Radio. And Gary is reporting remotely from Eaton Rapids, and Sue Majeure from Cadillac. So we could do a regular weather report up north in the center of the state in southwestern Michigan.
I thought
Kalamazoo.
Where is
did you move?
You said Cadillac.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was Sue in southwestern Michigan. Well, good. Well, now that you guys got me all straight, Sue, why don't you have a word of prayer for us?
Okay. Heavenly Father, thank you for this beautiful weather we're having and the upcoming weather that we've all been looking forward to after what seemed like a very long winter. It's been beautiful to look at all the spring flowers and the migrating birds and look at some of the things that are beginning to unfold and be excited that frost will be over so that you can plant the things that we look forward to planting. Help us to have a good season, good harvest, and to, most importantly, have it bring us closer to you and the things that you've created for us. In Jesus' name, amen.
You know, the weather has a profound effect on people's attitudes. We were at prayer meeting last night before we recorded this session, and literally something that happened that was highly unusual. Out of the people at prayer meeting, there were more praises. It was a 2-to-1 ratio at one point of praises to prayer requests. People were just in a good mood. They were feeling good about life because I think the weather was good.
Yeah, and they're in the nice sunshine too. Yeah, that always helps.
Well, one other thing is I walk home for lunch. I live next door from here at the studio. It's high. It's one of the higher parts in the Lower Peninsula as you come down the hill down to my house. And you look over the green trees, the green grass, the sky is blue. It's just, and the sun was warm. It just, life is good.
Yeah, it is. Hopefully, we'll have a nice summer.
Absolutely. Hey, we've got a quiz, and it's about blueberries, and I am so much into blueberries. We have two different varieties, a mid to late variety and a late variety, and we're getting ready to plant blueberries. So I'm all about blueberries right now.
All right, so here's the quiz and see if you're ready. Which type of blueberry is most commonly grown commercially in the United States? Is it low bush blueberries, rabbit eyes, high bush, or bilberry?
It's kind of tough, but I think I'll go with rabbit eye.
I'm going to go with high bush.
It's high bush. Yep. Okay, number two. Number two is a little easier because it's just true and false, so you have a 50% chance of getting it. Blueberries are native to Europe and were first domesticated there.
False.
What do you say, Tom?
False.
That's right. They're native to North America. Which U.S. state is traditionally the largest producer of cultivated blueberries? Is it California, Florida, Washington, or Texas?
You know, this far away, it's hard to say.
I'm going to say maybe Florida.
Okay, what are you going to go with, Tom?
I was thinking it was someplace out east, I'll say California because they produce a lot of fruit.
Nope, it's Washington State.
Because it's further north. It's further north.
Yeah.
Nailed us and again.
You have to remember, most commonly grown is high bush, and high bush is for cooler climates. Rabbit eyes are for warmer climates. Number four, what country is currently the world's largest exporter of blueberries due to rapid industry growth? Is it Egypt, Peru, India, or Turkey? This one should be easy.
I think I'm going to go with Peru.
Tom?
I've noticed that they've been exporting quite a bit from South America, so I think Peru's a good choice.
Yeah, Peru's a good choice because a lot of those other places are fairly warm.
Yeah, that's true.
And
trying to imagine
five,
growing blueberries in the Egyptian desert.
No, it's not going to happen. Now, this one should be easy, too. The wild lowbush blueberry is especially associated with what U.S. state? Now, notice this little bit of a hint. You don't see wild bush blueberries around here till you start getting around Clare.
How about Maine?
Is it Vermont? I forgot to give you the choices. Oregon, Georgia, or Maine?
Well, when I'm duly influenced because there was this childhood book, Blueberries for Sal, so I can't get Maine blueberries out of my mind.
I'm kind of thinking like that because they have quite a lot of the so-called wild blueberries come from Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And when I've been camping up north, we had the lowbush, we found them and we picked them. They're tiny, but good. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think I'm going to go with Maine, too.
That would be correct. Next, number six. This is true and false. Blueberries naturally contain blue pigment in their flesh.
False.
That seems false.
That's right. So most blueberries have either a pale green or whitish flesh. The blue color comes mainly from the waxy coating, and which we'll have a question on in a little bit, and the skin pigment. Okay, number seven. Which antioxidant compound is especially abundant in blueberries? Is it lycopene? Is it curcumin? Anthocyanin? Or capsaicin?
Anthocyanin.
Tom?
I think that'd be good because one of them is an element we had in a recent quiz, capsaicin. That's more with peppers and stuff.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's anthocyanin. Next one, number eight. Which Native American group historically used blueberries mixed with dried meat and fat in something called pemmican? Is it ancient Romans, Vikings, indigenous peoples of North America, Polynesian?
I'd say indigenous people of North America.
People of North America. The pemmican, I think they used to use venison or buffalo meat.
Now, if you guessed anything but the indigenous peoples of North America, you need to work on your test taking. Because it starts out saying, which Native American group? So I don't think we're going to have the Vikings or the Romans or the Polynesians. So if somebody got that wrong, I say, we need to have a discussion. Okay, number nine, which county in New Jersey is famous for commercial blueberry production and is sometimes called the Blueberry Capital Region? Is it Essex County, Bergen County, Atlantic County, from Mercer County?
Ooh. Go through them one more time.
I would go with the one that you're familiar with. Essex County, Bergen County, Atlantic County, or Mercer County?
Well, I'm not familiar with any of those, so I'm going to guess Atlantic.
Uh-huh. And Tom, what's yours?
I just kind of felt like an Essex or the B one.
No, Tom.
You just go with the clue.
It's Atlantic County, which is probably the same county Atlantic City is in. And there is a blueberry variety called Jersey. Okay.
Blue crop?
True or false? Pardon?
The Jersey blue crop?
No, blue crop is a separate one, but it's just called Jersey. It's an older variety. Okay, number 10, true or false? Blueberries belong to the same plant family as cranberries and azaleas.
True.
Azaleas make sense. Cranberries, but okay, if you say so.
Well, I've been into a bog walking, and they had both there, growing there. So I would think the same acidic environment would be where they would be.
Yeah, it's called the Irokesi. And number 11, which gives blueberries their dusty or silvery appearance? Is it salt crystals, fungal spores, natural sugar deposits, a protective wax coating called a bloom?
Bloom.
I'll go with the bloom.
Oh, yeah, that was a gimme. At least I thought so. Number 12, which blueberry variety is best adapted to warm southern climates?
That's got to be the rabbit.
The rabbit eye. Yeah, the choices were low bush, bilberry, northern high bush, rabbit eye, and you're correct. Okay, number 13, which country developed a major blueberry industry despite having very little native blueberry history? Is it Canada, Chile, Finland, Norway? And if you read your labels on the fruit during the winter, you'll know this answer.
I think it's Chile.
Chile.
That's exactly right.
I've been reading my food labels.
Yeah, well, it's a wise thing to do. All right, number 14 is true and false. Blueberries were one of the first foods ever frozen commercially in North America. True or false?
I'll say yes. It just seems like an answer.
Yeah, it might be. I might go with that. Let's go with true.
Their durability. They're not like a raspberry or a strawberry that's very perishable. So they're ideal because of their durability for the frozen food industry. So they were one of the first foods. Number 15, which surprising nutritional fact about blueberries is true? They contain more protein in eggs. They naturally contain caffeine. Their antioxidants are concentrated mostly in the skin. They're classified as citrus fruits. So now, this is a gimme if I ever saw one.
Wait, what was the last one?
Citrus.
They were classified as a citrus fruit.
I'm going to go with the concentrated in their skin.
The antioxidants. Definitely. Because anthocyanins, if I remember correctly, are antioxidants. Now, we have one bonus question.
All right.
It's considered difficult. But I'll give you a hint. If you know anything about variety names, you'll be able to get this one. The scientist most credited with helping domesticate modern blueberries in the early 1900s was Gregor Mendel, George Washington Carver, Frederick Colville, or Norman Borlaug.
What were the last two again?
Frederick Colville or Norman Borlaug. Remember, there
I don't
is
remember.
This guy.
Oh.
So, what is Gregor Mendel known for?
For
DNA and developing the theory with growing his peas.
That's right.
Yeah, he was involved in genetics. Throw him out.
George Washington Carver did peanuts and sweet potatoes and quite a few other things.
So we've eliminated those two. Who is it, Frederick Colville or Norman Borlaug?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I'll go with Colville.
Borlaug just sounds just right to me.
Are you sure? Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Way to go, Sue. Whoever heard of a blueberry Borlaug?
It sounded funny, so I was like, maybe Colville would be, they call it something like Colville Blue or something like that.
I tried my best to help you, Tom.
I know.
All right, that's the quiz. You guys did really well.
Well, thank you. Hey, listen.
I feel like that's one we actually know something a little about.
It was closer to home, that's why.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of that, I'm getting ready to plant some blueberries, so give us some quick hints on, maybe there'll be a rush on the blueberry department of plants of the nursery, but what do you have to do to grow blueberries? How do you plant them? What type of preparation, soil preparation, how deep do those holes go? Tell us how to make good blueberries.
Well, the biggest thing that you need to be concerned about with blueberries is the pH of the soil, because they like acidic soils, just like the cranberries do, just like azaleas do. And they like to be between 4.5 and 5.2. You'll hear slightly different depending on what references, but in that 4 to 5 range is ideal. And one of the reasons for that is they pick up iron more effectively at that pH. And now, most people do not have pHs that low, so ideally you'd like to lower the pH the year before you plant. Have you run a soil test on your soil?
Adjacent to it, not right there at that location. We have, somebody pointed it out that we have, the aquifer has a lot of lime or calcium in it, so that affects.
That would raise the pH over time. But what was the adjacent pH? Was it around 6 something?
I did my soil sampling this year. I haven't got back the report yet, and the last one is 1 or 2 years ago, so it's not top of memory.
Well, pH doesn't change that much unless you're putting lime down.
Okay.
Or an acidifying fertilizer. So homeowners don't use that much fertilizer to lower the pH significantly. So what was it when you last took it?
I'd have to look at the last report, and it'd take me a few minutes to find it.
Okay. Well, I do have a video on my YouTube channel that talks about acidifying the soil for blueberries, so you might want to check that out.
Will do.
But the other thing that's very important, up where you are, the soils are very sandy, and organic matter is something blueberries absolutely love. And so if you don't have any compost available, I'd go buy some peat moss and work quite a bit into that soil where you're planting them so that there's lots of organic matter. It makes a big difference in root development to have lots of organic matter. And when they need to be mulched to keep the weeds down, but also it helps to preserve moisture. And it's very important that you just keep adding mulch, because as that mulch breaks down and the worms work it, it increases the organic matter too.
Oh, thank you. Now, how generous can you be with the manure to, how much manure is too much if it's properly seasoned?
If it's properly seasoned, you won't have a problem with it. If it's at least a year old, it won't cause you any problems at all. You can put on as much as you want, because it takes quite a bit to change the organic matter level in your soil. So, do you have a tiller?
Yes, I do.
So I just pile it on about 10 inches tall and till that all in. That'll really help your blueberries.
Okay.
And as I said, they do not have root hairs, so they have trouble picking up water. So they need to not only be mulched, but they especially need water while they're being established. And I have something on blueberry fertilization, too, on YouTube that you could learn about how to fertilize your blueberry stuff.
And I'm sure other people will want to know what that YouTube, I know it's your last name, Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G.
Right. If you just type in Gary Heilig in any search engine, my YouTube channel will come up.
Great. I appreciate it. Well, we've completed this session, and we'll be back with more questions after this break. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Sue Majeure, Tom Majeure, and, of course, Gary Heilig.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio. Their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
The Garden Guy is back on Strong Tower Radio with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. Sue, you had a question. We were talking about blueberries, and we had to go to the break. Share that with us now.
Well, I was wondering, are pine needles a good mulch for blueberries? I mean, are they, like, acidic?
They are a good mulch because they don't break down as fast. They're not necessarily acidic, though, because we did some composting of lots of pine needles when we were doing a what's called Master Composter program. And then we did a complete nutrient analysis of the different compost, and the pH did not change appreciably with the pine needles. So it won't help with the pH. Now, if you haven't lowered the pH, Tom, you can still lower the pH through your fertilization program by using ammonium sulfate as your nitrogen source over the years. But also, you can add some sulfur, but you don't want to put on as much as you need at one time. You might spread that out over 2 or 3 years and try to drive it down. And if your pH is too high, you'll start to get what's called iron chlorosis, which means you'll have yellow leaves with dark green veins. And a blueberry that's at the proper pH will have nice dark green leaves. So that'll give you an indication how well you're doing.
Did you say ammonium sulfate?
Ammonium sulfate, 2100.
Okay. Now, isn't there aluminum sulfate?
Aluminum sulfate and iron sulfate will lower the pH. If you're going to use one or the other, I would use iron sulfate, but you have to use about 5 times as much as is recommended for the sulfur. And the problem when you put down some of these acidifying fertilizers, some of the material is slowly transformed into sulfuric acid, and if the concentration gets too high in the soil, it can actually damage the roots. That's why you want to try to do it before you even plant. But you still can't do it. You just can't put on as much at a time. Now, aluminum sulfate, I wouldn't use because we have plenty of aluminum in the soil, and you don't want to add too much. Either sulfur or iron sulfate. It's usually sold as ferrous sulfate.
Okay. Great. Any other question there, Sue?
No. Well, what would you recommend as the best mulch for blueberries?
Pine bark mulch will work, and it lasts quite a while. You can use regular mulch, like when you see the power company go through and cut up stuff and they grind it. you can use that. It's preferable that you don't have black walnut in that mix, because blueberries don't particularly like black walnut. But it won't necessarily kill them if there's a little bit of black walnut mixed in. But that's the
What is the name of that stuff? Fuglone or something like that?
Fuglones, yeah.
That the black walnut trees put out to poison their competition.
Yeah, it's you might say a growth inhibitor for certain plants. Other plants aren't affected by it at all.
You said pine bark. Now, with my red pines, the bark is pretty thin. Some people use pine bark, but it seems to be very thick. It probably comes from southern pines of some sort.
Can use that too. Yeah, you can use that too. Blueberries are very tolerant. You never have to take it off. As it starts to break down, you just add some more mulch on top of it.
So I have a pine stand, so just grab up all I can, needles and bark, and that's
if
good
you want
stuff.
To. Yeah. Now, realize that the pine needles act as a natural mulch under the tree, and if you take all those pine needles off, then you start to get weed growth under the tree.
But you decide.
So there's not much pruning to the blueberry bush plan, is there?
Not for the first few years. I also have a video on pruning blueberries. For the first few years, you don't have to do any pruning. But basically, when the plant's about 4 or 5 years old, you start to take out some of the older material, and that'll encourage new ones to come up. And what you want to do with blueberries is have about 20% 1 to 2 year old branches coming up, same percentage of 3 to 4 year old, then 5 to 6 year old, then 7 to 8 year old. After about 8 years, then you trim out 1 or 2 of them to keep sending up new ones. And so the most productive canes or branches are around the 3 to 5 year old branches. Then they get taller. That's why they're called high bush. And the blueberries, if you don't prune them, keep them at a certain height, usually around 3.5 to 4 feet, then the really older branches get taller, and they still produce blueberries, but they're usually smaller.
What about raspberries and blackberry planting? What words of wisdom do you have for that?
Well, they're pretty much easy to handle. They're like putting in tomatoes. You just have to make sure you get them at the right depth. And that's usually about an inch deeper than what they were in the nursery or in the pot that you bought. And depending on how fast you want them established, will determine what spacing you put them at. You can put them as close as 12 inches, although I tend to go more like 18, 24, because if you run a plant a lot, they will spread very quickly, and they'll even leave the area where you want them. So, but the first year, you don't really do anything. Now, with the regular raspberries, they grow what's called the primal cane the first year, and then they produce the second year. On some of the others, like black raspberries and purple raspberries and even blackberries, you prune them a little differently. You let the canes grow up, and then you cut them off at about 3 feet, and that allows them to branch out. And then the next spring, you cut those side branches shorter so that you don't have brambles all over the place, because the side branches can get very long, and it gets very unruly in terms of trying to pick.
Well, great.
And I do have a video on pruning ever-bearing raspberries, too, on my YouTube channel.
That would be good. I adore raspberries. Do they have many varieties of the gold? I got to taste those one time from Meijer's. They seldom have it. It was just like once or twice. But I know there's so many different varieties. But are the gold varieties adapted to our climate here, or do they prefer farther south?
That one I'd have to check on, but I would think that here in southern Michigan you wouldn't have much of a problem. It's possible that Tom might have a little bit of an issue since so far north, but that, I'd have to double check that. And look up the varieties, because all of them aren't the same. Some may be a little bit more hardy than others. And that's, again, where you can use AI, where you could ask the question, list all the commercially available yellow raspberry varieties and how hardy each one is, what their hardiness zone is, and boom, that'll tell you which ones you should pick.
Ah, good now, to know, because you don't plant the raspberries every year.
No, you only have to plant them once. If they survive, they're going to be everywhere. I have a raised bed that contained mine, and they're all out of the bed, and I have to cut them back, cut them down, dig them up, give them away. They're just everywhere. But if you're going to grow blueberries, raspberries, and strawberries, if you don't spray for the spotted wing Drosophila, you're eating maggots.
Ew.
You plant them 12 to 24 inches apart, but how wide are the rows?
Well, you don't want your row any wider than you can reach toward the middle from either side. So I would probably keep my row no wider than 2 feet.
2 feet?
Because the other thing you have to remember is when you're reaching in there, you will have raspberries that are ripening, you'll still have some flowers, and bees will be working. And the last thing you want to do is be reaching in very far, because if you get a bee sting, that's not pleasant. But at about 2 feet wide, you don't have a problem picking. It's much easier to deal with.
Very good. Well, June is the first rose blooms come out. What kind of care do we have for rose blooms?
Well, the reason I said that is because if you like to go to any rose garden, about mid-June is when you're at the best bloom of the year. And so hopefully you've been treating them for black spot, because black spot is a defoliating disease, and that's one of the reasons why roses don't survive as long in Michigan, because when you get a bad infection of that, it knocks off all the leaves, and without leaves, you can't develop sugars that will get them through the winter. And so they die of starvation, essentially. Also, after a rose has bloomed, you should trim that flower off right away. And what you do is you start from the tip and go back till you see the first or second group of 5 leaflets. And then cut just above that group of 5 leaflets at a 45-degree angle, about a quarter of an inch ahead on top of the stem next to the leaf, and that will encourage that bud to break, and then the plant will rebloom again. And also, in June, you might be watching out for rose slugs, which most people don't see them until they start to see what looks like part of the leaves missing. They don't consume it totally, but they kind of eat the surface, and that makes the plants look unattractive, so rose bugs start to show up. And a good organic product to use would be spinosad, and it covers quite a few different insects, and it's not toxic at all. And also, toward the end of June, you're going to be seeing beetles coming out, like rose chafers, and you need to treat for those guys too. And a little bit later, you'll run into the Japanese beetles, which can really do some damage.
Back to the black spot, what do you need to do about the black spot on the roses?
You have to use a fungicide, and a lot of the fungicides in the garden centers will take care of the problem. Or you can go on AI and say, what's the best known fungicide for black spot? And they'll tell you. If you want an organic option, they'll give you a suggestion. But once it starts, then you can't stop it. The leaves will get the black spot, they will turn yellow, then they'll fall off prematurely. And we probably could have had some infections already, because we had quite a bit of rain early in the spring. Now, it wasn't much of a problem when there were no leaves out, but black spot can also be on the stems from the previous year. So you have to watch that closely. And hopefully you fertilized your roses just before growth started, because roses really need fertilizer to produce those beautiful blooms. And a balanced fertilizer is sufficient.
Let's move on to fruit trees. you can still remove the suckers. How do you remove maggots and sooty blotches? That happens more on cherry trees, doesn't it, that sooty blotch?
No, it gets on apples. Now what gets on cherries is a different type of mildew. But the first thing that we're going to talk about before we mention the diseases was pruning. And the suckers, which grow up from the base of the tree, can be cut off at any time. The water sprouts, which are branches that grow straight up on the stem, they can be taken out at any time. And if you wait, they'll be put much bigger next year. And if you get started on them early, like June, you can almost rip them off with your hand because they haven't hardened up yet. So early June would be the best time to get to them, and it'll cut down on the amount of pruning you're going to have to do next year. Now, sooty blotch and fly speck usually starts around late June, and you have to put fungicides on to protect it. And there's not a good organic product that I'm aware of, but you might want to double check with AI to find that. Now, I use a material that most people aren't going to try to buy because it's just too expensive. It's called, if I remember correctly, it's called Nova. But Captan will work on that. It's just not as good as Nova. And, of course, this is also when good pruning to open up the canopy of the tree is important, because the longer it takes for the internal portion of the tree to dry out where you have fruit, the more likely you are to get a fungal infection like sooty blotch, fly speck, apple scab, and all those other things.
What about grape fungicides? Why do we use them?
One of the things that becomes a problem that usually shows up in June is something called black rot. And when it starts to cause problems, it makes the berries shrivel up and turn to raisins. And it does quite a bit of damage to a cluster. So if you go to MSU's website, the MSU Extension Bookstore, there is a bulletin we've talked about in the past. It's E150. It's a fruit pest management guide, and they'll tell you when you should put various fungicides on so that you can not have all your berries just rot on the vine. And, of course, you have to worry about Japanese beetles, usually late June, that you're going to have to watch for, because they can do quite a bit of damage also. But if you're not using a fungicide, most likely you're not going to get edible quality grapes.
What about vegetable burn down of weeds?
Well, a lot of times people will use Roundup, which does it, but there's a lot of controversy associated with Roundup. And one of the things that you can get from Home Depot is an organic version. Basically, it's acetic acid, which is the acid in vinegar. Only this acid is, you can get both 20%, and you can buy 50% acetic acid. Now, 50% acetic acid is nothing to play with, so you want to be careful. You would not want to get your nose anywhere near this, because it's not going to be a pleasant experience. But you can put these in a pump sprayer, and I have both. I'm going to try both to see which one, how fast they work, because the 50% is much more expensive. It's like $40 a gallon, as opposed to, I think, 22 or something like that for the 20%. And it should burn down weeds in your garden before you till. It won't kill roots, but it will make it easier to till. And so that's something you can use as an alternative to Roundup.
Now, if you get this on your vegetables, that will...
Oh, no, you don't want to do that. It's a general burn down. So this is something you would do before you put the vegetables in, or you would have to temporarily cover the vegetables if you were going between the row or something.
How far in advance would you use this burn down before you do your planting?
Ideally about 2 weeks. It might be three if they're really large vegetables or large weeds. And obviously you can't wait that long now because we're already getting ready to go into June. And you should have your garden planted by about mid-June. Otherwise, some of the things that take longer, like watermelon, just won't have enough time to ripen.
Very good.
So, but it's not too late to do it at this point.
Very good. Well, there's more questions for the Garden Guy in our next segment. You're listening to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. We'll be back after this break.
Hi, folks. Jelaine Fenner here. We are definitely living in uncertain times, and for some of us, it's scary. Signs of the times are everywhere. Jesus is coming back soon. Read Revelation chapter 22. Jesus says, "Surely I am coming quickly." We at Strong Tower Radio have a free book for you called The Great Controversy. Go to the back of the book and read chapters 35 to 42. It'll help you understand the times we're living in and what's ahead. This book even has 800 historical quotes and 1,200 Bible quotes. I love this book. Call Strong Tower Radio today, 231-468-2087, and ask for The Great Controversy while supplies last. And if we don't answer, please leave a message asking for The Great Controversy with your name, address, and phone number. That's 231-468-2087. On Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
You're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, affectionately known as the Garden Guy. Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. We're doing this from triangulating from three different locations. Sue is in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and Gary is in Eaton Rapid towards central Michigan, south of Lansing, and I'm in Cadillac. So we're trying to get the perspective from all different angles this month. Gary, the importance of pollinators. Those pollinators give us, they aren't just bees. Explain the wide variety of pollinators.
Okay, first of all, I got to ask you guys a question.
Uh-oh.
How many bee species do you think there are in Michigan?
Bee species. I was going to say four, but I'll probably be way under.
I'm thinking 400.
Sue was pretty good.
All right.
It's 460. Fewer in Indiana. But only about 50% of them are important for pollinating crops. Now, all the bees are important for pollination because they're more than just crops. They're trees, shrubs, flowers. Many different things that have to be pollinated, but for the important ag crops, about 50% of them. So that's over 200 species that are really important.
Well, with that in mind, how many of them are commercially viable or important to commercial agriculture?
Well, what you usually find is the European honeybee, which was brought to this country. And also, you can buy bumblebees. They're not quite the same as honeybees, but they do work inside better. So if you're growing something in a greenhouse and you need pollination, then bumblebees are the choice. But the most pollination that is done by solitary bees, like mason bees. And what people will do is, you've probably seen these little things where it's a series of tubes mm-hmm. that they'll set out in orchards and things. Those are for mason bee nesting, and most of the bees are solitary bees, and they nest in the ground. So we're getting all this for free without any extra stuff.
I bought one of those little bee houses for Tom.
She did.
Yeah, I have one too. I haven't put it out yet, but I'm going to try to do that this year.
So...
what do you think the next question, logical question, would be?
Where's the best place to put your bee house?
Well, you're close. How do you attract them? And all animals need three things: food, water, and shelter. Well, they take care of the shelter pretty much on their own, unless you have a little house for some solitary bees, which they'll take up residence if you put it out there. The food part is nectar from plants. And so when you first plant your vegetable garden, you don't have a lot of things not germinating, but flowering. But when you put a lot of flowering plants of different types around the edge of your garden, you will attract pollinators in, and they'll work both the flowers and they'll work your vegetables, depending on what their preference is. And also, having a little water available is helpful, too. A little pan of water that you change on a regular basis so that you don't get mosquitoes laying eggs in it. And that
with the marbles in it?
Marbles? I don't know about that one. What?
I've seen several videos where they show they have like a shallow pan, you know, something like a pie pan or something shallow like that. And they put a level of marbles in there and fill it up so that just up to the, not covering the marbles, but, you know, up towards the top. And that way they can perch on the marbles and not fall in and drown when they're drinking.
Yeah, you can also do that with very fine gravel. I have some pea gravel that you can do that with. And, that works for butterflies, too, if you're trying to attract butterflies. The same things that attract the pollinators also attract the butterflies.
Except for they don't need the host plants in the same way, do they?
Butterflies? Well, it depends.
No, the bees. I'm saying that the butterflies need the host plants.
Yeah. Yeah, they're primarily after nectar. They have their own houses. Because, for instance, with honeybees, they take the nectar and turn it into honey. What I call bee vomit. I don't eat honey because of that. I just said, no. But anyways, it's all on me. Honey is very good. My wife loves it.
When you say pollinators, the bees are just portions of that pollinator group. What part do bees play compared to moths and other plants?
They do the majority of the pollinating.
Okay.
I mean, you even have bats pollinating certain plants in the tropics, but they're insignificant overall when you look at all the different plants that have to be pollinated.
Okay.
But yeah, there's more than just bees, but they're the workhorse.
All right. Now, Gary, you brought this up a couple years ago about fertilizer and the price going to rise. It doesn't seem like the price has retreated anytime soon. And things at?
Well, the reason why fertilizer prices are high is because natural gas prices are high. Because one of the things is the war. Not only the Iranian war, but also the Russian-Ukrainian war is a bit of a problem because Russia was one of the world's largest exporters of fertilizers, and Belarus was one of the major potash exporters. And so with those sanctions, we're not getting those things. Those two together give a huge share of the fertilizer, so of course it's going to go up. Now China, which makes a lot of things, they restricted their exports because they're trying to protect their domestic food production. China does not have enough arable land to support their people, so they absolutely need what fertilizers they have available, so they're really restricting that. And so phosphate fertilizers, urea, ammonia, those are all things that are needed for fertilizers, and they're in short supply. Also, with all the things that are going on in the world, the transportation cost of rail, barges, ocean freighters, trucking, that's all gone up, and they just pass that on to the people. And there's some prices increases because of consolidation in the industry. The more competition you have, the lower prices generally are. We now have four major companies that deal with fertilizers. So naturally, the price will go up as a result of that. They peaked in 2022. They've come down a little bit, but they don't expect it to come down much more. So those are the reasons why we're paying such high prices for fertilizers. And so I always tell people, you should compost, because even though it doesn't replace fertilizer, it does add nutrients and other beneficial things back to the soil, which will help the plants to utilize what is put on. Because when you put a fertilizer on, if it doesn't attach to organic matter, it usually will just wash down through the soil faster. So those are the reasons.
Well, we've got an up-to-date report on fertilizers. Let's step back to vegetables, continued successive planting. Gary, I have to confess that I get all geared up and I do all my seeding in March, April, and inside, and then do direct to the ground, and that's it. It's it seems the summer comes on and multiple competing activities, but I think I need to pay more attention to successive planting. What can you do to motivate us or help me focus on successive planting?
Well, let me give you an example using radishes. Let's say you plant a whole row of radishes. They're already in about 28 days. How many radishes can you eat?
And also the shelf life.
Radishes will last quite a long time in the refrigerator. We're usually talking about a month or more. But the thing is, you're not going to eat that many radishes. So if you plant, let's say you wanted a row of radishes that was 10 feet long. You plant maybe 2 feet this week, wait a couple of weeks, plant 2 more feet, wait a couple of weeks, plant 2 more feet, wait a couple of weeks, plant 2 more feet. And that way, you're never overwhelmed with the harvest. Now, the time that having a harvest where everything is the same, let's use squash as an example. And I love butternut squash, and one of the things we do is we freeze it. Well, it's the kind of thing that we don't want a successive plant. What we want to do is have all the squash ready at the same time. We process it, and we're finished. But things like zucchini, well, that produces anyway for a very long time. It's a gift that keeps on giving. But there are certain things that you're not going to eat so much of it right away, and so either you're going to sell it or you're going to give it away, take it to church or something like that. If you don't mind doing that and losing quite a bit of the harvest, fine. But if you want a steady harvest, think about successive planting.
That would be good for, say, corn. So, because you can't corn on the cob for every meal for 2 weeks, you want a successive plant it so that you'll have some, and then the next group will come on, and then you'll have some, and so forth.
We have a farmer down the road that does just that. He usually starts in July, and he finishes up by about late August, and he has corn coming all that time, and we don't even grow corn anymore because the raccoons around here absolutely love it. So we just go down to his place and buy corn.
Now, is successive planting, tell us the crops. Do you want to do that with broccoli? Do you want to do it with kale? What are the prime targets besides radishes and corn?
You could do all those things. Cabbages, leafy greens, especially leafy greens because they get ready so fast and you just get blasted with a lot of them. Now, something like greens, for instance, when I grow mustard greens and turnip greens, it takes quite a few to serve a family of four. So you plant much larger amounts of them, but still successive planting will give you greens over a longer period of time. Broccoli is fine. One of the things that we did one year when the government was giving out these checks, I think they gave out $600, we bought a freezer because that year we grew so much broccoli, and it was just beautiful broccoli. So we basically filled that entire freezer with broccoli.
Wow.
And as you know, I love broccoli. We ate all of it. But there's most of the things that you grow in the garden can grow them that way, as long as it's not a long period of time from planting to harvest. You have to take into consideration how much growing time you have left.
Well, so in other words, you wouldn't want to try that with, like, say, watermelons.
No, no. Watermelon in Michigan, you need to get those in late May and have the ones that don't take as long, like some of the southern varieties, like the Charleston Gray, they take 130, 140 days, and you're not always guaranteed that here in Michigan.
Well, folks, this concludes the June edition of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Stay tuned. You can, if you miss something or want to hear something again, you share it with a friend. Want to go on our website, it will under archives, audio archives, and for Strong Tower Radio Today, and listen to it again. For
Hey, Gary, Tom.
What's that?
Are we going to be at camp meeting this year?
That's a great point, Gary. We did questions and answers during a session on Sunday afternoon at the Michigan camp meeting. It'll be on the first Sunday, the only Sunday of camp meeting. Join us at the Michigan camp meeting, and you can ask all your questions in person to Gary Heilig, the Garden Guy. Well, that wraps it up for this month for Good Growing. For Gary Heilig, Tom Majeur, and Sue Majeur, we'll see you again next month. Bye now.
Hello friends, this is Doug Batchelor from Amazing Facts. Strong Tower Radio is a station that believes in the power of prayer. In the book Steps to Christ, we're told, prayer is the opening of the heart to God as to a friend. Not that it's necessary in order to make known to God what we are, but in order to enable us to receive Him. Prayer does not bring God down to us, but brings us up to Him. What a beautiful promise of God's power for our lives. Do you have a special prayer request that you'd like for us to pray for? If so, call us at 877-278-5512 or send an email through our website, strongtowerradio.org. We have a team of prayer warriors standing by to join with you in taking your petitions to the throne of grace. God loves each of us so much, and He's waiting to hear from you.